I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today I am so happy to welcome Yadon Israel to the show. Yadon is a writer and the founder of Literary Swag, which is a cultural movement and book club aimed at making literature more accessible. Yadon is also a senior editor at Simon & Schuster. His very first acquisition, Temple Folk, was a finalist for the National Book Award last year, among many other honors. Today, Yadon and I talk about the literary landscape, how he thinks about authors promoting themselves and their work, and the many books that have shaped Yadon into the fine and upstanding literary citizen that he is. Remember, our book club title for the month of May is James Baldwin's classic, No Name in the Street. Yadon and I will be back here on Wednesday, May 29th to discuss the book. Quick reminder, everything we talk about on each episode of The Stacks can be found in the link in the show notes. If you love The Stacks and you want inside access to it, head over to patreon.com/thestacks and join The Stacks Pack. For just $5 a month, you get to join the best bookish community ever. We're on Discord, we have a monthly virtual book club meetup, and you get a bonus episode each month. You also get to know that by joining The Stacks Pack, you are making it possible for me to make this show every single week. Another fun perk of the Stacks Pack is getting a shout out on the podcast. So here's a huge thank you to our newest members, Danielle Lemon, Allison Smith, Sawyer Cole, Hiab DeBessai, Ivana, Mary Rogovin, Jenna Bustamante, and Susan Guertin. Thank you all so much. Oh, and if you're less interested in community but still want to support the work of the Stacks, head to tracythomas.substack.com to read my newsletter, which is all about books, pop culture, and whatever else I'm into. All right, now it's time for my conversation with Yadon Israel. All right, everybody, I am so excited. I have a guest on the podcast who I have been wanting to have on the podcast for at least a few years. We finally got our acts together. We are here. I am joined by editor at Simon & Schuster, Yadon Israel. Yadon, welcome to the Stacks.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to just clarify for your audience. I got my act together, not you. You was on your square. I was off mine. So I appreciate your patience and grace in allowing me to be on the show at all after the egregious amount of time I failed to respond to an email.
It's okay. We're here now and that's all that matters. Plus, if I had interviewed you originally, I wouldn't have been able to say that you are the editor of a National Book Award finalist because you were not that yet. So it was worth the wait to get to give you all your flowers and celebrate you. Before we get into all of that exciting, great stuff, will you just tell folks a little bit about yourself? Just like, you know, it doesn't have to be your resume. It could be about where you're from, other shit you're into. Just give us a sense of Yadon.
So for, you know, for people, you know, senior editor at Simon & Schuster, founder of the Literary Swag Book Club that's been around for 8.5 years. We're on our 99th pick. We announce our 100th pick next month and for our April. Got my MFA from the New School, got my undergraduate degree from Pace University. I was a judge for the national, I served on the board at the National Book Critics Circle. I was one of the jurors for, you know, the Aspensworth Literary Prize, for the New York Public Library, Scholastics. I taught at MFA programs from City College to St. Francis. Also taught at the New School. What else? Like, I was the editor-in-chief of Brooklyn Magazine. I'm a father. I'm a husband. I'm fly. Like, it's we run the gamut. Like, what you want to talk about? I could talk about anything in any different direction. But, like, I think that the way that I lay it out when I lay out my professional landscape, it's, you know, I've studied books as a student with the MFA degrees. I've taught them as a professor teaching. I know what kind of books get a certain kind of cultural and social coverage because I was an editor-in-chief of Brooklyn Magazine. I know what kind of books wins awards because I was judging prizes. Mm-hmm. And I also know what kind of books cultivate cultivates dialogue because I run a book club. So I consider, you know, being a senior editor at Simon & Schuster like the sixth Infinity Stone, you know, so that's why I'm here to snap, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So let me ask you this. I was going to ask you this way later, but now I just want to know, you know, so many different aspects of the world of books. What surprises you? What has surprised you about books?
I think how many people actually have their hands in it, in the bookmaking process. Being an outsider to the industry, and I want to make a distinction throughout this interview, a distinction between, like, you know, like a Venn diagram. There's the publishing industry and then there's the literary world. And like they have overlap, but they're not the same thing. They're not synonymous. Right. And often people use them as, like, you know, interchangeable. And so I was in the literary world longer than I was in the publishing industry. Only very recently, by getting this job at Simon & Schuster in 2021, have I become a part of the publishing industry. And because so much of the narrative of publishing comes from writers, there was this notion of, like, the sort of singular creator of the book. Like, so I probably thought about, like, you look at a book, you see a name on the front. You don't see the editors. You don't see, you know, the copy editors. You don't see the book designers. You don't see the marketers, the publicists, the sales team. And then when I got into publishing and now I'm doing the book, me helping to create the books, you see, like, there's about, like, anywhere between, you know, 10 to 20 people working on one book. And I think that it really expanded my understanding of books from this solitary pursuit to a communal endeavor. And so that's been the thing that's been most shocking, is just how many people work on one book, which to me really disrupt this notion that, like, you know, there's only two people making a book, but there's so many hands in a book that people don't even know.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I wish that books had credit pages. I wish that every book had it. Because I'm interested in who makes the books.
Well,
like,
I mean,
I have a tracker and I track who the editor is on every book I read and who the cover artist is. And I just wish it was easier to find that information and like to see an editor's career and see what they've done and who they've worked with. Like, I think that's exciting and interesting for people who like books. I just wish it was more accessible.
Yeah. I mean, and the acknowledgments are there, right?
And
the
acknowledgments, not everyone has acknowledgments, and not everyone names what everybody does
right.
in their acknowledgements.
And but I will say that I think that that has more to do with how writers conceive of labor and publishing. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. because writers are the most front-facing, I'm not saying that it's the writer's sole responsibility to do that. But I think that there is a way that being a product of an MFA program, being a product of a lot of the narratives of the romantic author as solitary creator, like I think that there's a lot of subconsciously internalized notions about how to acknowledge labor. And you know, the reality of it is like, I've never, you know, even when I sit through credits in a Marvel movie to wait for like, what's the next scene? It's not like I'm reading and seeing who was the gaffer, right? Like,
right.
But it's there for me to see. And what I have become more privy to becoming a part of the industry as an editor, I look at the acknowledgments and a lot of the information that we are looking for is there, right? Like some people don't have acknowledgments for, you know, like if you're a Stephen King or you're,
a
J.K. Rowling, you don't, you know, you as an editor, you don't want a million, you know, emails from people who want you to publish their, you know, horror. If you're an agent, you're not trying to field that many submissions. And so, you know, so there's a reason why that happens, but I will also say that that information is a lot easier to grasp. Like even on, you know, a hardcover book, if you look at, damn, I don't have one right in front of me. But if you look at like the end, like the back flap,
yeah,
you know who took the picture. You look on the inside flap on a copyright page, they tell you who designed the book. So the information is there. It's just, it's knowing where to find it and how to look for it. But to your point, it's like, how do you make it more accessible and more in your face and more explicit? And that, you know, a lot of what my labor is in publishing, my cultural work is creating a sort of vision, like creating a discourse that enables people to understand the nuances and the logistics of publishing so they know how to find these things that you are laying out you wish you saw more of.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm always just so curious because, you know, when you do start paying attention to who the editor is and who the designer is, you realize that, like, as a reader, you have favorite editors. Like, I realize that mm-hmm. Kathy Belden is my favorite editor, like, but I would never have known that if I wasn't reading the acknowledgments and like paying attention and seeing these things. Or like, you know, the guy who does the cover designs over at FSG, Rodrigo Corral, so I can't remember his name, but he's my fave and I love him and I love his work. But I never really it never clicked in my head until I started writing it down and like tracking it. Okay, let me ask you this. Because you have so many perspectives on the book space and you would like have these different hats that you've worn, when you're editing, what are you looking for in a book to acquire versus when you're picking a book for book club, what are you looking for in a book to talk about?
It's funny, but you know, not funny, but like, you know, what I appreciate about this question is that like, this is where a lot of my overlap is. Like, I'll be honest, like, I don't acquire a book that I wouldn't pick for the book club that I run. Like my book club in a lot of ways is informed my sensibility about what I would acquire. Like if I wouldn't pick it for book club, I wouldn't acquire it.
Okay.
I tell this story often because it's a core principle of how I look for books. So, you know, when Berry Gordy was running Motown was at the height. He would play a song for the songwriters and the executives and the marketers and everybody at Motown. And then he would cut the song off. And then he would be like, if you had your last $5, would you buy this song? Would you buy this record or would you buy a sandwich? And if people wanted to buy a sandwich, he didn't release the record. And the reason why he did that was because he understood that the people he was selling albums to didn't have $10. They didn't have Afterpay. They didn't have, you know, Affirm or any of these things that enabled you to get what you want now and pay for it later. A lot of people had to make a decision between like a Temptations or a Jackson 5 or, you know, a Diana Ross and the Supremes album and paying their rent or paying for dinner that night. And because he understood sort of what I would call like a sort of creative ethic, right? Which is if we're making stuff that we know isn't necessarily food, shelter, and clothing, we have to really be honest that that's what we're competing with. We're not competing with other artists. We're competing with people's livelihoods and their lifestyles. And so when I look at a book, my thing is like, okay, if this book is coming out in hardcover and that means $27, $28, $29, $30, even if it's paperback, $16, $17, $18, like that's somebody's dinner that night, that's somebody's lunch. Is this worth that person's lunch? Is this worth a pair, you know, a pack of diapers? Is this worth somebody's right. Hulu subscription? And that's how I think about the book. And when I'm making the assessment is like, if it's not already worth it, is like, what would make this worth it? And if the writer then is capable of doing those things. And that's the conversation I'm having, because when it comes to the book club, and this is just a little quick thing about the book club, is like the book club is a $50 subscription a month. Now, most people be like, that's a lot of money for a book club, especially when the book is not even $50, but it's the community, it's the accountability, it's the discussion. And what I realize is that when you create a book club, you're serving a very particular kind of person. It's a person who values not necessarily the books themselves, but the community and the ability to have a conversation about the books. And so I say that to say, like, my question, even when I was creating the book club, was like, how do I make this worth the money I'm charging? Versus like lowering the price and like, oh, well, trying to justify it. It's like, no, I just have to make sure that it feels like it's worth the investment. And that's how I assess books, like just the baseline. That's what I'm looking for. Is it going to be worth the money that someone pays and the time that someone invests?
Okay. So, but how do you know when you get a manuscript, what are you looking for to say this is worth the $30? Like, who are you talking to? How are you assessing that? Is that just something you feel in having known so much about books? Or like, are there specific things that you are looking for, a feeling or whatever?
Nah, so it's different with every book. I think the thing that unites all of it is that, like, I look at who is this book to? And I make this distinction all the time is like, you know, writers, as I've, you know, learned to understand, is that there's a distinction between who people write on, like, for, and then who writers write to. And oftentimes I've heard writers conflate them, where the person that they're often writing to is the person they think they're writing for, but ironically they're communicating them as the same way. So for example, right, like, you know, James Baldwin wrote a lot of his work, especially his nonfiction, for Black people, but it was written to white people. Right. So like, as a Black person, you could come and read Baldwin and you could feel very much seen by what he was describing. But because of how he described certain things, you knew he wasn't writing to a Black person, because there were things he was explaining, as Toni Morrison says, when she talks, she was like, there's things that he's the Ralph Ellisons of the world are explaining things to, like, you wouldn't have to explain that to me. So I know you're not talking to me. You're talking to someone else, but you are talking about me. And so I'm very much, inverted in terms of how I think about bookmaking. I think about the audience first, and then I reverse engineer it. So every book I'm encountering, if I can't see the audience and I can't see how to get this book from me as, you know, acquiring editor, through the publisher, through the bookseller, like through media and you know, the press and all these different things, it's like, how do I get this to the audience? And if I can't see that path, then I don't acquire the book.
I feel like a lot of people think of editors as like, they're people who edit the book. They tell you have a typo, or they say like, this paragraph has to go, or we should move the beginning to the end and the end to the beginning, or whatever. Like, let's rework this. But what I've learned about editors, which I really didn't know before I got into being part of the literary world, which I love that distinction, because I hate when people say you're part of the publishing industry. I'm like, I am not. I am a literary citizen. I'm part of the literary world, but I do not work in the industry. But what I've learned is that editors are really the entire project manager for a book. You are there from the beginning, you acquire the book, you do the editing, you talk about the structure, what the point of the book is, but also you're meeting with the sales team, you're meeting with the marketing team, you're meeting with the cover designers, you're helping to put together the book tour, you're helping to do all of these other parts of the book, and that the editing part is not necessarily the number one or like the only part of the job. It might be the number one part of the job, but it is not the only part of the job, and it is not the only important part of the job. So would you tell, like, kind of give us a condensed version of like what happens for you from the getting of a manuscript to the publication of a book, like what things your hand is in?
So I think the best analogy as a way to like help people think about what an editor, who an editor is and what an editor really does is like, think about an A&R at a record label, right? Like they're the ones, they're doing the development. They're, you know, they have a vision for everything about the book, right? And so they're really the person who's coming up with how do we translate the art to the public? The misleading thing and the difficult thing about navigating publishing is that publishing is B2B. Right. And when I teach classes, various classes to authors, to writers, to any, or even give lectures, I often ask people, how many of you buy your books from SimonandSchuster.com or PenguinRandomHouse.com and Macmillan? And PRH is one of the few, if not first, one of the few publishers who you can actually, they are building the tool so that you can buy the books directly from them. Our consumer directly is not the end user. Right. Mm-hmm. So like we're not necessarily the Apple store in the sense of like you can go to a Simon and Schuster store and buy Simon and Schuster books. We sell to Amazon and Barnes and Nobles and the Indies and this person and that person. And so the relationship that the reader, the end user, the consumer has with the books is not directly with the house. When I say I have my hand in everything, it's not even in terms of understanding that I'm publishing a book, and this is something that I've learned very recently, as you know, or have like accepted very recently, is like I'm not publishing books, I'm publishing brands. So every book I acquire, I'm not just looking at the book itself, like what's the writing. I'm looking at the entire person. Like what kind of person is this? How do they think about themselves in the world? What are not their just their interests outside of books, but who are they in the world? Who are their cultural equivalents, right? Mm-hmm. If they were in music, which artist would they be? If they was in sports, which athlete would they be? If they was in the sciences, like I'm thinking about who are they in the world, because the average person is not looking at them as an author. They're looking at them as like identifying with, is this person aligned with the values or the ethics that I identify with? And that purchase of their book is but an expression of their alignment, right? And that's what I'm really assessing is like, okay, there's times where I've seen books that are dope and then I've had interviews, not like interviews, but like, you know, author meetings. And there was just times where my vision for them was bigger than the vision they have for themselves. You can't, and it's like, I can't work with somebody who doesn't have a big vision for themselves, not just their book. Publishing is a long haul. 96%, this was in a New York Times article in 2021, when publishing had its best year, right, in terms of sold the most books. Even in the year with most publishing sold more books in the history of books, there was still two categories that outperformed everything else, and it was celebrity authors and backlist books, which is books that have been out longer than a year. Right. And really what they were seeing is that books between the year that were released out between 3 to 5 years were getting the most sales at a minimum and an onward, and then celebrities. Right. So like 96% of authors who debuted still sold under 5,000 copies. Toni Morrison, when her first book, Blue As I, got published, sold 2,500 copies. So you could look at that as like, oh, that's terrible. It's like, no, that's the name of the game. Like a new person is that they're a new brand. So if I'm going into the bookstore with my $30 and I'm looking at a trusted brand like a Tony or a James or an Octavia Butler or some book I probably heard for years and I'm just now going to get because, and then I see this new person I've never heard of. I see this new brand. It's like, am I going to pick Heinz ketchup that I always use and know, or I'm picking this other brand I've never seen before. And it's like, there's a finite amount of people that, which is represented in the statistics. There's a 4% chance that I pick up the new brand over the established one. Right. And so when I realized that I'm not publishing books, I'm publishing brands, I've had to reconfigure my entire messaging about how to help authors understand that really what you're doing is you're building a career with every book. Yeah. You're not necessarily trying to get one book to define your career. And that's what so many authors try to do, is try to get their first book to be the definitive one, as opposed to like the one that's going to set the foundation for their career.
What's so interesting, Yadon, and like this is something that I have been thinking about a lot, because I just did a tour for this podcast and I had authors and we talked and we did it at like nightclubs and comedy clubs in five cities.
You know, we didn't.
We had a great time. We didn't do it in bookstores. And one of the things I realized in that tour, I mean, it took me some time after the fact, but one of my big takeaways is that book events, as we know them, as like these places when you go into a bookstore and they have neon lights on and like you sit between the bookshelves and the author like reads five pages and then talks to their friend about the book, is that we're doing it wrong. Is that the least interesting part of the book event is actually the book. Yes. And that everyone else thinks that the most interesting part of the book event is the book. Yeah. But like if the book just came out 2 days ago, maybe three people have read it in the room. Why are you trying to convince me that I want to hear you read aloud, like person that I don't know,
right,
or person that I already know and love, and that's why I'm here? I don't want to read those three pages. I'm going to buy the book. I'm going to take it home. You've already sold me. I showed up. I came out in the rain in Los Angeles to see you talk. And I feel like what we're missing is that the authors, like you're saying, the brand, the people, they are the product. They are the interesting thing. And if they can't be sold, and if they can't sell themselves, and if they can't make us excited about them, maybe I'll buy your book off of a great review in the New York Times, but I don't know that I'm going to buy your second book because I'm going to forget about you by then, you know? But like, if you excite me, if you are a person who I'm delighted by, I will remember you even if I thought your first book was just okay. Or your third book, you know? And so I feel like this idea of like, let's go into a bookstore and sit in folding chairs and have no experience and not consider the audience or the reader in any meaningful way is doing a disservice to the people who show up, but also to the authors and their ability to build careers off of like creating brands for themselves.
Yeah. And one thing, as you were speaking, I know, like, I've been on the side of writers in such a way where I know they're going to cringe at the notion of them being products. And it's like, I want to make a very clear distinction that, like, when I talk about branding, I'm not talking about them commodifying themselves. What I'm talking about is understanding that that transition from writer to author.
Yes, and this author.
That is like you're going from the private artist to the public figure. There's a way in which, whether a writer likes it or not, part of what they accept when they accept a book deal is that there is a kind of repositioning and reconfiguration they have to do to decide not just that they're going to present themselves to the public, but how. And what many contemporary writers, and when I say many, what I'm saying is, like, for every 10 writers I encounter, seven possess this mindset that they're in the headspace of like, all I got to do is really write my best books and disappear and I don't have to do anything. And they're really articulating an antiquated notion of how publishing used to work. But ironically, the way that publishing used to work really only benefited a minority of the people who are getting books published, right? And so there is something that, right, like, that the challenge that I try to get authors to think about is, how do you make genuine connections with the people who are going to become your readership, right? Like, maybe that, you know, 20 people show up to your book event, and then three people buy a book, it doesn't mean that that event was a failure. It means that you have to think about, how do I make sure that those 17 people feel like this time that they spent with me was worth it? And so often when we have these conversations in publishing with authors about branding, the first thing they hear is, oh, I got to go on social media, I got to post. And it's actually a lot more challenging than that. It's like, no, you actually have to present your humanity in a way to the people who you know will recognize it and value it. And that's a different kind of labor, in extension to the labor that most writers think that they're only responsible for, which is writing the book, right? So to your point about, like, people in the publishing industry think that, like, oh, we have to sell the book. And what I'm understanding is, like, no, you have to create experiences that will enable people to value the person who is the conveyor of this experience, and then they will invest in the book. So there's like data that shows that the top two things that sell people's books better than anything, first, number one is known author, right? And then number two is close friends. And so there's a network and community effect of how, like, we sell everything, and yet we still put, as an industry, an overwhelming amount of pressure on, like, oh, this book got a New York Times review, but it didn't sell. And it's like, on the data will show you that book reviews aren't the one things that move the needle. And yet we still put a disproportionate amount of energy into reviews, where it's like, okay, what's harder to build, and this comes back to publishing being business to business, is that when you're a B2B company, it's very difficult for people within that framework to think about an end user because we don't interface with them directly. A lot of editors, in order to have that vision, they have to be plugged into, like, they have to be deeply invested in what's actually going on. But the conundrum of this job is that part of what gets you to even do this job is that you, to an extent, you're cut off because you're editing books, you're reading manuscripts. Right. So you have to find, it's this like really tight, this high wire effect where you have to both be engaged enough to know what's happening and what could happen, but then committed and disciplined enough to make sure that the books that you're already acquiring are being executed at that level that, you know, are worth the investment that you make when you fight for the acquisition in the first place. So it's not by means an easy thing.
No, it's not. And I think, like, you know, I think it's funny, your pushback of me saying that the author is the product.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I went to theater school. And so I know so many actors and dancers and things, and so many artists feel like, oh, I'm not a product. Like, I'm an artist. And I always laugh at that, because I'm like, baby, you're selling art. What do you think that is? Yeah. Like, that's a product, honey. Like, you want me to buy it. You better act like it. But I just think it's funny because authors, especially, I feel like from what I've seen for the years that I've been working, you know, in the space, is like, authors don't want to think of themselves as a product or as a brand. And I'm like, it feels so clear from the outside, like as a reader who interfaces with so many readers, right? Like, I'm the opposite of a publishing industry. I am interfacing only with the end product for the most part. And so to me, I'm like, no, you are a brand. And like, when I think of authors who are doing it well, or like even people who, you know, their first book, I was like, you're going to be a thing, right? Like, I knew, like, to who comes to mind to me instantly is Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya, right? Like, the moment I read Friday Black, I was like, I'm interested in this person, the person behind these words. And then I started following him, and I would see like, oh, he's into Pokemon. Like, what a surprise. Oh, he's like, it's like you get to see these glimpses of this person, and all of a sudden he becomes a very clear brand in my mind, right? Like, I'm like, this is there's a clear story being told, not only on the page, but as the person. So maybe like product isn't a great idea, but like thinking, like you're saying, of the packaging of the person as like part and parcel with the art and not separate from the art, but like the person who makes the art is as exciting to the consumer as the art itself,
right?
If you let it be,
right? And I would say that, like, while the person isn't the product, their book is definitely the product, right? And that's right. That so it's,
and them as an author is a product, maybe not their whole person, maybe not the writer, but like the author part, right? To me, is a product.
This is going to come down to semantics. I know how you're saying it. Like, the reason why I'm saying product, because it's like, you can buy people, like, depending on where you are.
Sure.
But it's the notion of, and this is what I keep coming back to, and everything I do, I think about who's listening to this and what they might hear. And it's like, I'm being very sagacious about how I'm framing things, because part of what I'm always trying to dislodge is the kind of stubbornness that writers think is benefiting them, and it's actually harming their careers. And so they think, oh, I'm just going to focus on my art in this vacuum, right? And it's going to just work out. And what a lot of authors are taking for granted is that that way of navigating through publishing only worked for a finite amount of people. One.
Yes.
Two, that way of working no longer exists. Like, the world has changed 4 or 5 times since that kind of author was able to exist in that way. So, like, if you're thinking about the John Irvings, the Don DeLillos, the people who they were writing in a different generation. So they've already built their sort of base audience, right? It's why like a Beyonce can drop an album without promotion.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh my God, but it's like her brand was already 20 years strong at that point.
Right.
So somebody who has no brand history, no, like you said, no relationship with the larger public, or at least the people that they're trying to reach, and they do the same thing. And they're like, well, Beyonce did it. It's like we're doing an unfair one-to-one where we're not looking at trajectories, and we're isolating moments in people's careers, and we're saying we want that. So like the last thing I'll say before you ask your next question is like Toni Morrison, I tell this to writers all the time. Toni Morrison's first book was in 1970, so 2,500 copies. She doesn't get her first bestseller until Beloved. That's 17 years later. That's four novels in between, right? That's a career, right? Yeah. And so, and she doesn't become an international figure until 1992 when she wins the Nobel, right? And it's not like she was writing with the intention to get a Nobel, but she was building with every book meaningful and consequential connections with her audience. So by the time she passes in 2019, I believe, and she has that, I never forget, I covered this, I covered her memorial at like, I think Riverside Church. That room is filled, you know, with Black women. And it's like, there's other, a lot of other people there, but it was disproportionately with Black women. And when you look at her career, it's like she has been doing both on the page, but in her work, in her interviews, the same kind of labor, but that's a 40, 50 year campaign.
Yeah.
And so you have writers who go, okay, I want what Toni had 50, like at over 40 years on my first book. And it's like, Toni didn't even get that on her first book.
Right.
So I like sometimes looking at the big authors who people like to look at and go, I want that kind of career. And I go, let's look at the career.
Yeah.
You want to look at the moment, like the Nobel. And it's like, yeah, but there's a lot of her books getting reviewed wrong. There's a lot of her books not finding people. They're like, you needed a whole Oprah to kind of come up and create a whole initiative extended to, like you said, the literary industry. You needed somebody outside of publishing to create a galvanization for literature like hers, for it to even have the kind of mainstream, you know, breakthrough that it has. So I say this to say, like, a lot of what I try to challenge writers to think about, and I tell them this all the time, it is very easy to, every writer comes to me and they all believe they have the exceptional book that's going to break all the rules. And what I ask them is, are you comfortable being the rule and not the exception? Because if you're not comfortable being the rule and not the exception, there's very little, honestly and truly, exceptional about you. Because even if you drop one good book, the world is going to want the next one, right? And you don't build a career by showing up to work on time for a year and then showing up late or not showing up at all for the, you get fired, right? And so I try to challenge writers to think long term instead of short term. And that's really like in really terms hard. Of what we talk. Yeah, it's just a, it is a framework shift because no one's educating writers to think about their careers. The implicit and explicit language is about what are you working on now?
Right. The one book at a time.
The one book at a time. They're not looking at, okay, where do I see my career 30 years from now? And which book is going to be the book that helps me buy my house? Which is the book that's going to help me, you know, get that residency? Which book is, if I want to teach, which book is going to get me? They're not looking at things like that. What a lot of this romanticism with art and artists does is it makes art and artists very exploitable.
Right.
Because they are not assessing the value of their work and they're not doing a harder labor of understanding what their cultural leverage and levers are to make good on the value they believe that their art is doing.
Okay, we're gonna take a quick break and then do a hard shift. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality. And I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, we're back from our break. Here's the hard shift. We do a thing called Ask the Stacks where someone writes in and they want a book recommendation from us. So I'm going to read the question and then we're going to come up with at least one. I've got three. You can do anywhere between one and three. So the question is from a person named Mary, and they say, I would love some recommendations for narrative nonfiction written by women.
Ooh, oh, we love it. Narrative nonfiction is written about women. Now, here's my subtext. I don't know if she answered this. Does she want it to be about women or just it has to be written by women?
All she wrote was some recommendations for narrative nonfiction.
Narrative nonfiction, some of my favorites. Random Family by Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc.
Yes.
One of my favorite books of all time. Follows this family in the South Bronx over 12. She's lived with the family for 12 years. It started as her following this. She was reporting on this teenage drug dealer named Boy George, who was a heroin kingpin at 17, got like 20 years in jail. But she ended up taking a liking to one of his girlfriends who was a teenager. Her name was Jessica. And she was just really taken with how this young girl has so much power and her ability to move through spaces. And she ended up following her family for 12 years. And she tells that story. Brilliant book, Random Family. If people haven't read Braden Sweetgrass, I know it's a perennial bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list. Robin Wall Kimmerer, definitely a fire book. And it's about but she does a lot to reconcile. She's an indigenous woman and she's like articulating the link between like the Western construct of science around nature and then the indigenous wisdom that is its own science. And she does it through like beautiful storytelling. Another book that I really love from a storytelling standpoint, Franchise by The Golden Arches in Black America, Marcia Shatilan. Brilliant book about the relationship between McDonald's and Black people in America and how, when we talk about branding, like McDonald's as a global corporation understood the value of telling meaningful stories to a community. And of as much as we can talk about, and it's true, the unhealthiness of McDonald's. But when we talk about seeing ourselves in our products, seeing ourselves in companies, McDonald's has understood the importance of that. And so they were creating campaigns, you know, that were specifically geared to the Black American community. And it shows like, you know, whether you're a capitalism and all those things accounted for, it's like there is a value that people who see themselves being validated and legitimized in the storytelling of how something functions has consequential outcomes for any company, brand, or whatever. So, like, that's definitely another one. What are yours?
Okay. I could keep going, but yeah. You did good. You did so good. So One of mine I haven't read yet, but it's the one that I'm going to read next.
Okay.
It's called The Brothers by Masha Gessen, and it's about the two brothers who were behind the Boston Marathon attacks in 2013. And I love Masha Gessen, and so that's what I'm going to do.
Okay.
The next one is tied to yours for Random Family, which is We Were Once a Family by Roxana Azgarian, which is the book about the Hart family murders. But it's a similar kind of like following the story. A journalist follows these people. And it's, you know, I found it to be fantastic. Also, Invisible Child is sort of in conversation with those two by Andrea Elliott.
Okay.
And then the other one I picked is like much more narrative. It's Liliana's Invincible Summer by Christina Rivera Garza. And it's like sort of her investigation into her sister's murder 30 years ago in Mexico. And she goes back and she like compiles letters from the sister to and from her friends and interviews the friends and like kind of tries to figure out what happened. But it ends up just being like a love letter to her sister, which is just so beautiful.
Right.
So those are my picks. For people who want book recommendations read on air, email askthestacks@thestackspodcast.com. And Mary, if you read any of our books, let us know what you thought.
Yeah.
Okay, here we go, Yadon. Two books you love, one book you hate.
Okay, two books I love off the top. I definitely want to put Hilton Ahl's The Women. That book really shifted and expanded the way I think about my relationships with women. And before I became an editor and I was still writing, I was not really considering the interior lives of women before I read that book. I didn't have a framework to do so, and that book gave me that. So that's always going to be a perennial two book, like one of the two I love. Another book I love. Ooh, God damn it. I'm sorry. I feel so much pressure.
I know. I'm sorry.
No. Okay. It's
just
good.
Two books you love today.
Today? Multiply Divide by Wendy S. Walters. I think it's an essay collection written by a brilliant Black woman. And half of the essays are fiction and the other half are nonfiction. But what she tells you in the beginning, she tells you which ones are imagined and which ones are real. And then when you're reading some of the real ones, you forget. When you're reading, you're finding, I found myself going back to the beginning of the book and like, wait, this one didn't happen. Then you think, there's things you think didn't happen that did and things that you think did that didn't. And so what she does with just form and how she uses the essay as a way to get us to interrogate how we experience reality and then how we talk about reality. Like that was definitely genre expanding for me in terms of what can be done with on the page. So Wendy S. Walters and Hilton Ahl's Women.
Okay, book you hate.
All right, so I don't hate books.
Oh, come on.
No, I'm not. But the genuine God, like I don't hate books. I will tell you a book that I'm like annoyed by.
Okay.
That functions in that realm of what gets at the heart of your question is definitely The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell.
Oh my God, don't get me started on him.
But like that, this is me being a young entrepreneur trying to figure out how to create some tipping points myself. And I bought that book very excited to like, you know, I thought it was in a Jonah Berger contagious space, right? Or maybe like the Adam Grant kind of book. And I read that book and left not knowing how the shit tips. Like, I was just like, yo, the main premise of the book is like, it's not there. When I talk to people about that book, and it's sometimes how I know people read the book or not, because they're like, oh, I love that book. And then when I give my assessment, they go, I don't think I ever finished it. It's like, so it's one of those books that I know, like, he's a wonderful storyteller.
Yes.
But I think that what people fall in love with is the storytelling at the expense of like what the promise of the book was supposed to be. Yeah. Right. And I wasn't expecting like, here's the secret to creating your tipping point. But he actually never explains how things tip. So even that famous example of like those kids in Lower East Side Manhattan who popped off hush puppies, he doesn't explain how it happened. He just explains that it happened. And I was like, yeah, this dude is a piece of work. He does that in all his books, but you only got to grift me once before I'm good.
Yeah, yeah. So, oh, well, I think for me, I read a lot of his books because I really liked the storytelling. And then as I got to be a more discerning reader, I was like, wait a fucking second, pal. Yeah, nah, I was like, Yeah.
He's selling wolf tickets.
What are you reading right now?
What am I reading right now? I'm reading a lot of things. And then this is aside from, you know, what I'm reading for my job. I'm reading comedy book, How Comedy Conquered Culture and the Magic That Makes It Work, Jason David Fox. Ooh. One, I would say, hands down, the most brilliant book I've read about like comedy as theory, comedy as construct, and comedy as cultural criticism. And he really makes the case every chapter is broken down to a different theme, some timing, truth, politics. And it's about the role comedians play in our culture. And like, he gives the art its necessary attention. And I think that part of what makes art is how we talk about it, not just what's made.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so like that's definitely one of them ones. What else am I reading? I'm reading actually this new book called American Flannel.
Oh yeah, because
I love clothes. Anybody who knows me know I love clothes, and I especially love textures. But the name of the book is American Flannel. This is another one with a long ass subtitle that I'm a fan. How a Band of Entrepreneurs Are Bringing the Art and Business of Making Clothes Back Home. I started that one. That shit is fire.
How much reading do you do for like outside of acquisitions, manuscripts versus like reading finished books or upcoming books or books that are, you know, not yours?
I would say this is why the work be killing me. It feels like almost 50-50. Like I feel like if I have 10 books I'm reading, 5 of them are just outside because I'm always looking for inspiration. Another book I'm looking at, Celebrity Nation, How America Evolved Into a Culture of Fans and Followers by Landon Y. Jones. And some fiction on that list to let you know my shit is a little bit diverse, and I got to get some poetry in there too. LaToya Watkins,
ooh,
that long list book, you know, and I love these lists because they get that shit is about, she about that work. Oh my God, like she's really good.
Wait, I know what I didn't ask you earlier that I have to ask you.
What's up?
What did it feel like to have your book, Temple Folk, that you acquired and edited? It was your first first published, but not first acquisition.
No, it was my first acquisition.
It was the first acquisition, but not first published.
It's the second to come out. The first I acquired. Yeah.
How did that feel when you found out that it was longlisted for the National Book Award?
You know, and the reason why I can say this is because I got the receipts. I felt gratified because I caught that shot. You know, and when you said it, when you did the introduction and you was like, you know, at that time you wouldn't have been that. It's like, I think it actually would have been a more historical interview because I would have said what I would have told everybody on that, like, this is going to be nominated for the National Book Award, because when I presented it to sales, I was like, this is the kind of book that's going to get this is the kind of book that gets nominated for a National Book Award. And we have to have like, we create like a goal list for all the things we want in our thing. Mm. And I remember being like, this was one of them, like, oh, the National Book Award, this is going to be a National Book Award finalist. And I remember, you know, the room was kind of like, oh, you're still new like that. And then the long list happened. And then now I'm getting these emails. And they're like, oh, my God. And then the short list happened. They're like, what? And I'm like, yo, like, I know. And sometimes that's part of what this is you just got to trust what you know. And you don't interrogate why you know it too much, because then you discredit a part of a muscle you've built. Right. Like, you don't second guess how do you walk, because you trust that your legs know what to do. Right. But if you had to explain how you walk, you probably end up sitting down because you like, this is too hard. So I trust it. Like, I know that this is the kind of book that gets the kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, all I got to do is make sure I stay out the fucking way of it. And ill is that, like, it's also a shortlisted for the Aspen Words Literary Prize.
Yeah.
It's it was longlisted for the Story Prize. Like, we got some other stuff that's coming out for, like, some other stuff that's coming down the pipeline. Like, this is one of those books, and the flex of it was I found it on the internet. Yeah. Like, that was like 2 days into the job, and I did an open call, and I was like, yo, submit to me directly. And that's the book that's on the National Book Award finalist list. So it's like, that's to me it's not that I was going to get that thing. It was the fact that it's how you do it. Everybody know, like, you know, when you doing ill shit, the ill is not the outcome. It's the it's the way you did it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Oh, I love that. That's probably going to be the title of this episode. The ill is not the outcome.
Yeah.
Okay. This is sort of our fast fire round because we're also running out of time.
All right.
But what is the last book that made you laugh?
The person that comes to mind is Samantha Irby. Like, wow, no, thank you. Like, so laughed out loud. Like, she's that woman. It's very hard to accomplish comedic timing on the page, but she does it.
She does it.
Yeah.
Consistently, too.
Consistently. She's ill.
What about the last book that made you cry?
Books don't make me cry.
Never.
Nah. I felt that warm feeling that, like, movies and TV shows make me cry.
Okay.
And it's because it's like there's like an unexpected thing that happens. Like, unexpected kindness makes me emotional.
Mm.
And there's like, I need a lot to make me cry. Like, you know, being raised in a patriarchal society, they've done a really good job on us.
I see. Okay.
So I mean, I can recognize, like, oh, that's touching. But, like, yeah, crying, I can't say a book has made me cry.
Okay.
I want that experience. Last thing I'll say, like, I'm curious to know what book has made you cry. Cause I will say, I don't believe when people say the book be making them cry, because it's just never happened for me. So I don't, like,
I don't cry a lot when I read. Okay. I'm not an aggressive crier in life or in reading, but the book that made me cry the most was A Little Life.
Okay.
I wept. But a book that recently made me cry was, I didn't have tears coming down my face, but I had tears in my eyes.
Welling.
Two different times when I read Let Us Descend.
There
were two moments in that book where I was like, oh. So but I am not an aggressive crier. I know people are. I don't read in a way that I emote while I'm reading.
Yeah.
So, like, I also don't laugh out loud that much when I read. What about the last book that made you angry? And it could be for any reason. There's many reasons a book can make you angry, but just the last one that you felt like.
Angry. Medical apartheid made me angry.
Yeah.
Harriet A. Washington. That shit. Because it was just like, yo, they ain't no chill.
No.
Like, this is like all the time. Like, just like, anybody who hasn't read that book, it's about the medical history, the relationship between Black people in the medical field. And it's just very hard to get through that book and not throw it across the room. Like, that book made me, like, I felt myself getting, like, like hot.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, damn, now I'm supposed to get on a train after reading this shit.
Yeah. Do you have any books that you feel embarrassed about never having read?
What was the book I used to lie a lot about reading? Because when I think about embarrassment, it's like, oh, I'm not embarrassed. Yeah. And it's like, nah, I got to think about it through the lens of which book did I lie about reading. Oh, I read that. I think I would say Old Man and the Sea, Ernest Hemingway. That book, I've, like, embarrassed by not reading, not because I actually have felt embarrassment, but because I felt so compelled to not just say I didn't read it.
Right.
Like, I would have lost nothing in a conversation, and if anything, I would have gained a lot by admitting it, because every time I've admitted what I didn't read, it actually created an opportunity for me to learn about the book that made me want to read it, versus, like, being in a conversation where I realized, because I just lied, I got to sit here and be like, yeah, exactly. Right. Like, or, you know, so I got to give that man his respect. Like, he wanted them ones too. I mean,
yeah,
I don't go look for him on a weekend, but he wanted them ones.
Okay. The answer cannot be yourself. Okay. It's not a memoir.
Okay.
Who would you want to write the book of your life?
You know, it's ill. I be knowing questions be coming. And I still be getting smacked in the face by them.
I don't ask this one very often, but I just know you know so many writers.
I'm gonna put a big flex on this. I know I'm gonna be one of them ones who go and get one of them those big biographies.
Yeah, I think so. That's why I'm curious to know who you want.
I would really want Imani Perry.
Yes,
that's who comes to mind immediately.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, a dream.
She has a deep understanding of, like, the deeper implications of personhood. And she understands, like I first encountered her work when she, the Lorraine and Me, And the way she was able to like intertwine the, her narrative with Lorraine, like it was just like, yeah, nah, she got that MacArthur for a reason. So
yeah,
Imani Perry first comes to mind for me.
Okay, last one. If you could require the current president of the United States to read this, to read one book, what would you want it to be?
Yeah, I mean, what would I give that man to read? I think Dying of Whiteness. I would give that man Dying of Whiteness by Jonathan Metzl, because I think that whole trying to play that holier than thou approach, like I'm not Trump, and that's not a convincing platform to run on. And I think that when you understand, like when I read that book, it really articulated, it really even broke me out of some of it. It gave language to some things that it's like, it's easy to kind of play that. What is it called? That moralizing, like, I can't believe people voted for Trump, but you know, what W.E.B. Du Bois called the psychological wages of whiteness is a real like investment. Right.
Yeah.
And we don't think about how white people pay for that investment in the ways that black and brown people do. Right. Like we can look at like a Kanye and see his endorsement of Trump as like largely incomplete in a lot of ways, counterintuitive and delusional. Same thing with a Candace Owens. But when we look at white people who do it, we tend to kind of go, oh, they're white, so it kind of makes sense. And what that book lays out is like, no, it doesn't even make sense for a lot of the white people who voted.
Yeah.
They're voting against their interests. And because of the narrative that they have, how powerful the narrative is, I think that, you know, Joe can benefit, you know, Mr. President can benefit from understanding that there are other things that motivate people to do things that are that function outside of quote unquote realm logic and shame. Right. Like there's this emotional thing of being forgotten and feeling forgotten, and somebody who's going to take up your cause. It's a really powerful notion that we like the people on this left or whatever you want to call them, the Democrat Party, they're not engaging with the human being. They're engaging with this higher moral person. That's like when people are scared and people are uncertain, they want to hear, they want somebody who makes them feel like they can believe in something, and he's not really giving people something to believe in. And I think that that's like, if a politician is good at anything, if a politician can't do that, I don't know. Yeah. They gotta do something else. That's my assessment.
It's such a good recommendation. Okay, everybody. Yadon will be back with me May 29th to discuss our book club pick for the month, No Name in the Street by James Baldwin. So go read the book. Yadon, thank you so much for being here. This was awesome.
Thank you for having me. And I appreciate everybody that's listening, you know.
And everybody else, we will see you in the stacks. All right, y'all, that does it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you again to Yadon for being my guest. Don't forget, the Stacks Book Club pick for May is No Name in the Street by James Baldwin. Yadon will be back to discuss that book with us on Wednesday, May 29th. If you love the show and you want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks to join the Stacks Pack, and check out my Substack at tracythomas.substack.com. Make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts or Spotify, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram, Threads, and TikTok, and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegeerigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.
These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.